I'm here in the home of Emerita Professor Beirute Csiplakaite. It's December 27th, 2012. And Beirute, could you pronounce your name in the proper way? Mm-hmm. I've heard so many varied pronunciations.
Beirute Csiplakaite.
Thank you very much. Well, let's begin at the beginning. Where and when were you born?
In 1929 in Kaunas, Lithuania.
Okay. Can you give me an idea of the of your family background, of the milieu into which you were born? I'm thinking, you know, maybe class issues, what your parents did, where they were from, how far back your family was able to trace its history and the very complex history of that area.
Well, they were both born on a farm in the country. That's where most Lithuanians came from at the time they were born. And then, of course, they developed little by little. The war came, so both during the 1418 war, both went to Russia, both fled to Russia from the German occupation, and actually mother finished high school there. Father, I suppose, had already high school. And at the end of the war, they came back to Lithuania. And they met only when they're back in Lithuania and got married. And then we, even in the little Lithuania, we were not a stable family, because father very soon became a very famous gynecologist. And not only that, but he was also apparently a very good administrator. So when in 33, I think, one part of Lithuania, which had been occupied by Germans longer, was finally given back to Lithuania, father was sent there directly to found the hospital. And these were from 33 to 39. These were my best years of my life, really, the most beautiful, because the Lithuanian community was rather small, rather select, because all went there to establish the functioning of Lithuanian institutions and everything. We had very good high school, I think. For me, what I best remember is the Conservatory of Music. It was absolutely incredible. And as I say, these were very, very happy times. Then when Germans occupied Klaipeda again in 39, we went to Kaunas, our capital at that time. But then very quickly, very soon, our ancient capital, Vilnius, came back to Lithuania from Poland. So father was asked to go to Vilnius to organize a hospital there. So I remember one year he was in Vilnius and we still were in Kaunas. That is why my education was very rather mixed up. Started in Klaipeda, the first class of high school already. Then Kaunas, then Vilnius. And we stayed in Vilnius not that long. Then we were transferred back to Kaunas. So I don't remember whether I graduated from high school. No, because then the war came again and we had to flee to Germany. So I finished actually Lithuanian high school in Germany, in Tübingen.
Fascinating. So you say the war started. Mm-hmm. By that you mean the Soviet invasion of Lithuania. Yeah. And what year was that in? Was that 1940? I believe
that was 1940 something.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it was maybe 1940.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the front was coming already to Lithuania.
Yes.
And yeah. We knew that we couldn't stay because actually any outstanding people of Lithuania already during the first occupation, the Russians deported to Siberia and killed.
Yes.
And we were only saved because at that point, father already was in Vilnius.
Okay.
So when all these searches by the Russians were done for the people, in Vilnius we found out that they came to get us to take to Siberia in the house where we had lived.
Really,
before.
They had identified
yes.
your family and
yeah.
they wanted
so,
to
oh, if we hadn't moved,
deported, yeah.
we would be long dead.
So really it was your father's prescience
yes.
and
yes.
and luck somewhat.
Yes.
That
oh, absolutely.
Yes. I hear this story so often.
Yeah.
This is true of Gerda's family, Gerda
Werner's
family
yes.
also.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. No, no, in Lithuania, I know here there is one Lithuanian lady. It happened exactly the same to her family.
Hmm.
They also moved, I think, also to Vilnius, and the Russians came to get them in Kaunas.
Hmm. So you went to Germany, and was that because you had German connections?
We had nothing.
Really?
Was absolutely
you knew
nothing.
No one, you didn't have
absolutely
ethnic
nothing. What mother had to go through is absolutely incredible because mm-hmm. 4 months before father died.
Yeah.
Mother who had never taken care of anything. He took care of everything. There she was with three small daughters in a foreign country.
So your father died shortly after you arrived in Germany?
No, before.
Before you even left?
Before we left.
And
mother had to organize.
My goodness.
Yes.
So he died of natural causes?
Heart attack.
Heart attack. Mm-hmm. Maybe just partially the stress of all
Partially, but he had had, he always overworked.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
he had had heart trouble
mm-hmm.
in the mm-hmm. last few years at least.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I I'm so grateful to mother and admire her so much that a woman who had everything, who didn't have to take care of anything because everything was done by father, and suddenly with three children in a foreign country.
My goodness, yes. And didn't speak the language or?
Yeah, mother spoke.
She spoke German.
Spoke German.
Yeah.
And
well,
we spoke German because at school we had learned.
Of course, yeah. Because there were strong connections in ethnic connections in Lithuania with Germany or that
yeah,
part of the
but
world.
But not everybody spoke German. No. We
right.
since we were in Klaipeda, which mm-hmm. was more populated with the Germans, and in school we had more emphasis on German.
Okay.
And actually at home, ever since we were babies, we had a German Fräulein.
I see.
So
okay.
We spoke.
Yes, yes. You learned
yeah.
as part of your education.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, before we move on to your time in Germany, I wanted to ask a bit about the world of middle-class Lithuania
mm-hmm.
that you grew up in.
Mm-hmm. I think in Lithuania that was probably even considered higher.
Higher, okay, mm-hmm. yes. And this was, as we know, an extremely contested area with a very rich history.
Yeah.
And like so many of those areas in that part of the world, was constantly under
changing
change and mm-hmm. War. And we know all of the horrible and rich history of that area. But it sounds as if this period that you mention after World War I
mm-hmm.
was a kind of blossoming of a sense of potential and possibility in Lithuania.
Future. And it's not only Lithuania, you see. All the Baltic countries, Latvia and Estonia, went through the same.
Mm-hmm.
Also, suddenly free and suddenly organizing. And I think the three countries did very well in relatively very few years.
Mm-hmm.
We had very well-functioning state and people lived, I think, relatively well.
Did you have domestic help at home for
Yes.
You had people, a cook. And,
there was a cook and there was a maid. Mm-hmm. And then we had the Fräulein.
Mm-hmm. To help with the children.
Yes.
So there was you and your sister.
Two sisters.
Okay. And what were their names?
Jūrate and Danutė.
Okay. Very nice. All right, so you, your mother, and your two sisters then were really at the threat of your lives, forced to move to Germany in, say, 1940, something like that. What was it like there in the war years? You were there from when to when?
Well, I, as I say, I can't remember the date now.
Yes.
Was it 39? Was it
probably 39 or 40?
I think so.
39 was when the Soviets invaded.
Yeah, and so we had to. Everything. I believe very much that in life everything is just by chance. On the border, my mother's parents had a farm very, very near the border to Germany. So we first went there, and as we were crossing the border, rather young person joined us, whom we had not met before, and she had connections with some people who had come to work in Lithuania for some years and was going there. So she said, well, why don't you go to the same place? Because we had absolutely nobody. And we went, and that was in Sudetenland. That was the part of Czechoslovakia occupied by Germans.
So you were there in that very chaotic place.
Exactly, yeah. While Germany still had the power.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, of course, since we were foreigners, the Germans didn't treat the foreigners with great love and generosity. We were all put to work. I was 12 years old or something like that, and I had to work in a munition factory.
Oh, my God.
And my sister, my older sister worked in the factory. Only my younger sister was allowed to go to school. Mother, I think, was not forced to work. Since she was a widow, she had three children, so mm-hmm. I think. But my sister and I worked for the German Rüstung. Oh, yeah.
In the Sudetenland.
Yes, in Sudetenland. Oh,
So that was all the time you were there, basically, that is
until the end of the war.
Okay.
Until the end of the war.
So basically, you, in those years, you were not in school, you were not...
My older sister and I, we only worked.
Yeah. Well, that must have been really...
it was not easy.
Not easy.
Certainly not
imagine.
Easy.
Mm-mm. Yes.
But my memory blocked it out completely. I don't remember anything unpleasant. I remember the beauty of the country. We also met some very nice people who were helpful as far as they could.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that, and probably I was too young to feel unhappy. So it was all right.
Well, children, you know, younger people are flexible.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, you tend to...
Adjust
and look at the positive.
Mm-hmm.
So did you ever feel threatened or discriminated against, or were those, you know, forced to work long, difficult hours?
Discriminated. I mean, I think every foreigner at that point in Germany was discriminated against. We were inferior.
Yes.
Yeah, but we didn't feel inferior. I think that's important.
Yes. 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 I mean, essentially, one became almost a a slave of that regime.
Exactly.
And it became more and more extreme as the war went on.
Yeah, but there was self-confidence left in us.
Well, that's so good that you were that able was all right. to...
No, really, and I think Mother, again, she resisted. As I say, we met very nice people. Then we got in contact with some other relatives of ours who had fled somewhere much farther west. And as the war ended, we went to meet that one cousin, the father's brother's son, who had established himself in Tübingen, that was already in Württemberg. And that is where a more normal life started, really.
Okay.
Yeah. It was already not war, and it wasn't easy either, because, of course, then we had the occupation forces. So we were not independent, and we were in the French occupation zone.
So this was, after...
At the end of the war.
After 45. Okay.
Yes,
so
exactly.
During the war years, you spent in the Sudeten.
In Sudetenland.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then as the war ended, you moved... And you were able to do that without any major traumas or in this extremely
disruptive. We did not feel that trauma. I don't know how Mother managed economically. I still can't. I mean, she had brought out some money, and little by little she was selling her jewelry.
Okay.
So
she made do.
Yes, she made do, and we certainly didn't feel poor, but I think the most important thing is that we didn't feel inferior.
Yes.
Really not.
And in a way, she protected you from what was going on
in
this incredible,
very much
disrupted and cruel world that you found yourself. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's amazing.
And then in Tübingen, there were quite a few after the war Lithuanian refugees. So we had even a Lithuanian high school. And I finished the high school there. So you can imagine that my education has not been regular at all. Because, again, the teachers there were people who were there and who could do that or that or that. But I was very lucky. I had some good teachers.
So it was the Lycée Lituanienne Tübingen.
Mm-hmm.
In 47, you
but I
received
got
your
my
BA.
Diploma.
Mm-hmm. And this was the French sector.
That was the French sector, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And actually, I didn't know any English. I learned English when I came to Canada.
How fascinating. Mm. So in that city, you had more opportunities, obviously, for education, for not working in a very...
Because as I say, the occupation forces, the French occupation forces in Tübingen, they supplied us with the necessary to survive.
Okay.
And in the French zone, we were fortunate. The American occupation zone, everybody had to live in camps. The French allowed us to live in private houses.
Really?
Yes.
That's...
It was a big difference.
A big difference.
Big difference.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what was the reason for that.
There were many differences. And the English zone up north in Germany was also very different. But there I don't have any exact details. But I know that it also was quite different from the French and from the American. But they made it possible for those thousands and thousands of refugees to continue a human life, to try to go to school. My sister went right away to the university in Tübingen, and we managed.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds as if you ended up in the right zone.
I think so.
In terms of opportunity.
Yes, I am really grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you were, I imagine, as refugees, aware of both the differences and the opportunities, one had to be very, very at attention in these situations.
I think I was too young to think about these things.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But your mother obviously mm-hmm. was the one. And she then developed a circle of support there, or friends?
Well,
or
friends, there were very many Lithuanians. There were some friends that were friends already in Lithuania.
Very nice.
So, it was a happy colony, really. It was a much poorer colony than people who lived in the American zone.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we had more freedom, we had more culture accessible, and I don't think anybody felt unhappy, really.
And your interactions with officialdom were with the French bureaucrats, or was there a local structure in place already?
I really can't tell you about
it.
I don't know. But everything, as I say, we still were completely separated from the Germans. And the Germans were not easy, because then when the end of the war, the universities opened. So each university was obliged, I don't know whether each, but several universities were obliged to admit a quota of refugee students. So that is how I got into the university. But as an example, I went to a very small branch of Mainz University, which was mainly a Dolmetscher Hochschule for interpreters. We were that year, when it opened, they were had to admit 40 foreigners. So we were 40 foreigners. After the first year exams, we were 7 left. The Germans knew how to handle what they wanted.
Mm. Well, that is a strategy that works.
Yeah.
And how did you survive? I mean, you must have been superior in the sense that
I was a good student, absolutely.
So they really
simply couldn't say that I don't do the work. No. And because there are also a few French professors there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the French professors saw very well the situation. Mm-hmm. So, no, I have absolutely no complaint. I think that is where I learned very much, because it was a small school, very strict. It was very difficult to do all those translating exercises. But
it, in a sense, made your career.
Absolutely.
Because, yes.
Absolutely.
You realized that you had this talent, and also, you had been deprived of education, and this was, I imagine,
to make up as much as you could.
But,
I mean, that is not the end, because when then we had to emigrate, we knew that we couldn't stay, in Germany forever. So we emigrated to Canada.
Yes.
My older sister and I, mother and the other sister, went to the States. But in order to be admitted to either U.S. or Canada, you had to sign a contract, a year's contract, to work as a maid.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So I worked as a maid.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask one more question about this time in Tübingen.
Mm-hmm.
So the Germans, it sounds as if they didn't learn anything in terms of diversity, shall we say, when after the war, that they still looked at foreigners. We're resuming after a short break the interview with Professor Cipliskaite. So to finish up with your time in Germany, would you like to say a few final words about some of your experiences there?
Well, after all, there is where I got the base for my education. And I also we met very, very good people everywhere. I really cannot complain. And the level of education was high. I did not feel inferior at all when I went to Canada. I had learned quite a bit.
Well, I mean, that's extraordinary when you think of what's going on around you at that time. Mm. And as we've said before, it obviously was, to some extent, your mother protecting you and giving you these opportunities and really preparing the way for you to flourish.
Yes.
So you had this quite intensive short education in Tübingen that indicated and confirmed that you had this great facility with language.
Yes. Yes.
And so...
And especially also gave myself confidence. Yes. When you were treated, you know, like dirt kind of, I could beat those who treated me like dirt.
Yes. It became your competitive and your self-confidence and your sense of well, I'm sure it was a sense of hurt and discrimination for the way you'd been treated when you first arrived.
Yes.
Were overcome by these efforts on your behalf to get a great education. So, okay, so how did you end up in Canada?
Well, as I said, there were possibilities to sign a contract for a year work. And you could go to South America, you could go to the States, you could go to Canada. Several of our friends had gone to Canada and seemed happy, so my older sister and I went to Canada.
And the contract you signed was for what?
To doing work as a maid.
Domestic work.
Domestic work for a year.
For 1 year.
Yes.
Okay. And your mother and your younger sister...
Went to the States.
Okay. And they ended up where? In
Chicago? Oh, no. They first ended up somewhere on the West Coast.
Okay.
But not very long, because then mother got in touch with everybody else. As you know, there is a very, very large Lithuanian community in Chicago and around. And so she managed to...
Okay.
To go out there.
Was that difficult to be separated then from your mother and younger sister, or were you...
Well, you had to accept it. You couldn't think about it.
Okay. So you're in Canada and you're doing domestic work.
Oh, yes. But I was lucky all my life through. I ended up with a family. He was English baronet and she was from the States, but she was very, very interesting woman. And I suppose she noticed that I wasn't just a simple maid. So she said, well, you have to do the work and you will do the work. But if you want, we were each entitled to 2 hours interruption for rest during the day. So she said, if you want to use these 2 hours going to the living room and playing the piano, that's fine. So that's what I did.
And you had already had lessons as a child?
Oh my piano. I started piano when I that's, I think, something that I should say. I always wanted to do what my older sister did. So when she started piano and went to the conservatory, I said, was crying, I wanted to play the piano, and I wanted to go to the conservatory. Mother said, well, nobody takes a child of 5 years old. And she finally took me to the director of the music school so that he would tell me the truth. He looked at me, and I was just a midget, totally told you. He looked at me and he said, what do you realize with your hands? What could you do? Well, so they did not accept me. He said, when you get to be 6, then you will be accepted. But at home, then I made my compositions and I played my compositions with my little hands.
So you loved music
from
very young age.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great.
It was a very musical family. Both my father and mother had beautiful voices and and sang, you know, from time to time, and with friends or anything. So that I really grew up very much in the music.
So you're in Canada, and you have this opportunity to practice the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened?
Oh, because it was, I was not only practicing the piano, I was also taking, I think it was twice a week in the afternoon, I went out to a business school to learn typing. Because in Germany, at the University of Interpreters, I had learned to translate, and I had learned shorthand, but I didn't know how to type. So I learned typing, and when I finished my year's contract, I started working as a secretary.
Okay, so you did that for
for as long as I lived in Canada.
And that was until 19... Well, you went to, you got an MA at the University of Montreal.
Yeah, but that 56. I did working full time during the day and going to evening classes.
I see.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. But you really did have this impetus to educate yourself.
Well, I knew that I didn't want to be secretary all my life.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
So you did that for quite a few years,
Oh, yes, I did.
45 to, yeah, okay. Yeah. So were there any, you finished at Montreal with your MA in, what was the subject that you?
In Spanish.
In Spanish. So already you had gravitated to Spanish.
Yes, yes, because you realize it took quite a few years until I got to the MA because I only had one course at a time.
Indeed, yeah.
And in this time, I also, I think, saved enough money to go to Spain. And I went to a summer course in Spain. I don't remember now. I think it was 53. And that is where it became very clear to me what I wanted to do in my life.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a teacher. It was more this experience of Spain in 1953,
but it was totally a teacher. I went to Spain not to travel. I went to Spain to a summer course, and there was that teacher. He gave us a short course on Spanish poetry, and he read poems when he talked about the authors. And after hearing two poems, I knew that I cannot live otherwise.
Ah.
So absolutely, I owe everything to him.
Do you recall his name? Or?
Of course.
Yes.
José Manuel Blecua.
Okay.
He was a great scholar in Spain.
It's amazing how when you speak with professors and scholars, they often say there's one person.
Oh, to me, without him, I don't know. Who I would be and where I would be.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So do you have any remembrance of what Spain was like in 53, or were you pretty much just there to take the course?
Well, I was there to take the courses, but I also traveled quite a bit. Everything was rather primitive still, because, you know, and then, of course, there was still the oppression, the Franco. But for that, I was too young. I never was interested in politics. So there I would not venture a judgment. But, I mean, there was enough freedom for a young student, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So I did quite a bit of traveling already then. How I did, I don't know. I think if I wanted to go somewhere, bought a train ticket, then I spent the whole day without eating. But that was all right.
Mm-hmm. So you saw the real traditional Spain.
Oh, very much. Oh, yes. Yeah. Before all the influx of tourists.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And all of the construction and all of the
electrification. Oh, totally. Totally. And you see, I was very, fortunate. I went to that summer school was in the Pyrenees, in the north, where there were practically no tourists.
Mm, and beautiful.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Beautiful.
And wonderful people. Everywhere I met wonderful people. I think the world has more good people than bad. Only everybody talks about bad people.
I think that's true. Mm. I think it's, well, anyway. So you had this experience in Spain, and this really inspired you in your life's work.
Yes, that made me then really register as a full student at the University of Montreal when I came back. But I still could only attend evening classes because I worked during the day. But it worked.
That must have been challenging.
But oh, it was. It was. Yeah.
And so then you had this opportunity to pursue your doctorate. Where did that come from?
Well, that is, I met, I think, a student in Spain who had gone to Bryn Mawr. And when I was back in Montreal and taking my evening classes and rather unhappy that I, you know, didn't know how to get ahead on anything, she said, well, why don't you apply for a fellowship at Bryn Mawr? It's a good school. I wrote, applied, and got it.
So this was a full fellowship?
Yes, that was a full fellowship. Yeah, oh, at Bryn Mawr you couldn't do halfway. Mm-hmm. It was such hard work.
Mm-hmm. So you ended up at Bryn Mawr
in
1956, I guess it would be, 57?
Probably. I don't remember the dates anymore. And in 2 years, I fulfilled all the requirements and passed the exams and got my degree.
So was there a professor there that you worked with?
Oh, yes, yes. That's like one, like Blekwa, who inspired by the poetry and beauty. And at Bryn Mawr, Ferrat Zermora, the famous philosopher, but he taught also Spanish and all that, who was so strict and so critical that you had to work your head off if you wanted to get anywhere. I remember the first assignment in the seminar, I had to present make a presentation of one poet. And I spent the whole week reading everything. Had pages and pages of notes and had everything organized and started presenting it in class. And so he interrupted me and said, well, you say that he learned something from Heidegger, so could you explain to us what ideas of Heidegger he took? That's the way you worked with him. So it was a very good experience to write a dissertation because I knew that he will not let anything go through that wasn't well done.
And you were well trained. This, you know, it was difficult, it was critical,
exactly.
But it was
exactly
excellent.
Oh, it was absolutely wonderful.
And just gave wonderful. You the self-confidence, yes. I imagine.
Yes. Oh, is, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Really. Mm. Oh. But I mean, until the very end, I didn't know for the prelims and everything, I didn't know whether I would pass or not until one friend had to go to talk to, I think, to the director of the whole section. And then she came out and she said, you know, I saw notes about your exams. And everybody said, excellent. Well, from then on, I knew that I make it.
Any other reminiscences about Bryn Mawr? Were
people
that you met there, fellow students, or you weren't there too long?
No. And there was so much work that mm-hmm. But I went every Friday I went to the symphony in Philadelphia. Mm. And that was Eugene Ormandy. And that helped to survive.
I imagine. Much.
My friends, when they saw me going off every Friday, they said, you will never pass the prelims. because mm-hmm. everybody just used every minute mm-hmm. for studying. But I passed. I passed the prelims and was very happy.
And this was at, in those years, a all-female school.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
And were the most of the professors women?
No.
Or were most of them were men in those
most
years?
Most of them were men.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the women were the students, the men were the professors.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
Well, this will start us on, at some point we'll speak about being a woman in academic life at a time.
Oh, at the time when I started.
There were very few women.
Very few. Yes. Well, when I came for an interview here, the chairman, you know, condescendingly said, well, last year we hired the first woman. I looked at him and said, I didn't know you were so backward. Never forgave me.
That's a great response.
But I came to Madison, actually. You know, I knew nothing about the academic life in the States or anything.
Yeah.
But there were openings, a few openings, and somebody looked at them. And one of my professors, I think, and said, well, but you know, they have recently hired one product of ours, and or product or other, she was had been maybe an instructor, Germaine Bray. Germaine Bray came from Bryn Mawr. Without Germaine Bray's name, I would have never come to Madison.
How amazing. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, to finish up with Bryn Mawr, so was there a sense amongst the students that this was unacceptable, that they were, you know, they were working very difficult mm-hmm. courses that were taught all by men who, in a sense, treated them in a inferior way, I would imagine.
No, John. I wouldn't say. I was very happy at Bryn Mawr.
Really?
Very
you
happy.
You didn't feel at all that this was
a kind of strange setup?
That,
no.
Okay.
No.
Because these were very dedicated people.
Absolutely.
Great teachers.
Absolutely. Yeah. They looked for your intelligence and not for your gender.
Okay. And they have obviously expected something of you, or they wouldn't have been training you.
I was very, very happy at Bryn Mawr.
Okay.
That was great luck.
Great. Okay. So you came to Madison somewhat on the heels of Germaine Bray and were welcomed with this rather rude comment by the chair of the department.
Yes.
So you then were given the position of assistant professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese in the year 1960. You were hired as an instructor.
Yes.
Tell me what the department was like in that year, those early years here, what the university was like. Mm. We'll start there, and then maybe we can talk about specific individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps first a kind of overview, and then we'll talk about.
Well, you know, I cannot talk much about the university as such because I didn't have such an overview. But our department in those days was considered as number one, sharing the number one was Harvard.
Really?
It was a very strong department. So.
And it was strong because of the faculty. Can you talk a
because
bit about
of
some
the
of
faculty,
these faculty members?
In modern, we had Sanchez Barbudo, who was absolutely wonderful. We had a very strong medieval section and very strong Golden Age section. So that in each... I think at that point of Latin America was only starting. It still didn't have a great name. But, I mean, the Golden Age and the medieval were considered of the best in the country.
And are there particular people in those fields that you would say, made that the case? I mean, was it the
Oh, yes. And each one in a very different way. For instance, there was Lloyd Kasten, who specialized in editing old texts, you know, when there was not enough material, no way to find all the information. I think he was very strict. He trained the students really well. And then we had Max Singleton in the Golden Age. And that was, again, I think the students were very well prepared. Very, very well prepared.
It sounds as if it was a...
Yes, it was really an excellent department. Mm-hmm. And flexible enough.
And, I'll ask you just briefly, are there particular students from that era that then went on, that you remember that went on to great careers?
Many of them went. And for me, it was a tremendous satisfaction. Last year, we had a big symposium of the early ages here, and something like 10 or 15 of my former students from the 60s came to give papers, now all very well-known names. So it was a confirmation that once upon a time, we were one of the best departments in the country.
And many of these people are now still major positions.
And producing good writing and very, very healthy scholarship.
Mm.
Yes. I was lucky. I was lucky all the way.
You arrived in Madison, you could almost say, at the golden age of your department.
Oh, absolutely.
There were great opportunities with the expansion of the university in those years.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And Madison, of course, for many, many years, had built some great departments in the humanities and, of course, in many other parts of the university.
Yes. Well, yes, because our department even built a publishing section for old texts. That I think is extraordinary.
And that the materials, one would hope, are in our libraries or somewhere. I mean, someone has kept track of all of this.
Yes, I think so.
So how were you received in the department?
I have no comment about that. There was that one woman. There were the
do you remember her name? Or
yes, Betsy Brooks.
Betsy Brooks.
I don't think she was a great scholar. There was, for me, the great figure was Sanchez Bermuda in the modern. He was really. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, and what our department also had, which was excellent, the program of visiting scholars. There were always visiting scholars from Spain, from Portugal. And that enriches the department tremendously.
Yeah. That was common throughout the humanities at the universities.
Yes.
At the University of Wisconsin in those years.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Would you say that Sanchez Bermuda was your mentor in the department?
No, I was already formed.
Okay. Who helped you in terms of the 10-year process? Did you have any kind of help?
There was absolutely no process.
Really?
No. Absolutely nothing.
How did one go about gaining tenure?
I don't know. I don't know.
How funny.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially there was just a decision by the
administration? Mm-hmm.
That
the executive committee at this
point attained tenure.
Yeah, I think so. Because I don't remember any questioning, any details, any conditions, anything.
It wasn't this set number of years, and then you had, you know, an intense amount of pressure.
Mm.
By that time, had you published a book or articles?
I was publishing quite a bit.
Okay, well then that, and your teaching was was obviously satisfactory.
I suppose it was satisfactory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like your first book was published in Spain.
Most of my books were published in Spain.
In 62.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That was my dissertation, I think. Mm-hmm. Rewritten, but still, you know.
So, would it be Soledad? Would you say that's solitude? Solitude and Spanish contemporary Spanish poetry. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, and it looks as if every couple of years, then for many years, you published a book.
And
as you said,
quite a number of articles.
Yes, indeed. So you're in the department. You're obviously very, very engaged in your work, inspired by your work. Engaging with some excellent students that you were helping
yes.
to train.
Yes, and, we had wonderful students. Yeah.
So did you become friends with Germaine Bray then in those years?
No, because you see, that was already her outgoing years,
I see.
In a
okay.
way. And yeah. she was much older than I. And I think I had too much respect for her.
Yeah.
No, I didn't have a close relationship. No.
Okay. We'll talk about your scholarly work soon. But any more insights into what Madison was like in those years of the expansion of the university, of the probably, as we had said, the golden years of the humanities on campus, some of the great figures and some of the friends that you met and made long lifetime friendships with. Thinking, you know, of Marjorie and George.
Well, exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. that was the beauty, that it wasn't such a huge university. You could spread out through different departments and get to know the people. And I used to go sometimes to different lectures or even classes or anything, you know, to keep track of what was going on. And also Madison always had, the university, the wonderful system of bringing in scholars from different countries.
Mm-hmm. Which created an excitement.
Yes.
An engagement between scholars
very
in
much
various
because
departments.
It was a different approach usually. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. It really was enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you met George Mossy in those years.
Yes, then? Yes. Oh, that was one of the lucky things that happened to you, because I mean he was so enriching.
And you shortly after you arrived, you were already an assistant professor 1 year after you arrived, and then you became tenured in four years after you arrived, and were a full professor 8 years after you arrived, and then had a named professorship in 1973, 13 years after you arrived, which was in recognition of your scholarly accomplishments.
I suppose, you know, nobody ever discussed any of that with me. Okay. I just found that they were doing it.
That you had been awarded this distinguished professorship. How did you feel? And what was the atmosphere as a woman in those early years in your department as a teacher?
Didn't feel any animosity.
Really?
No.
You didn't feel any lack of opportunity or maybe a dismissal of you because you
to a certain extent, probably, but I mean, that was everywhere
right.
at that
so
point.
So you basically had learned that how to deal with these situations was to just really be excellent, better than any of the men.
That you have to be, in a way.
Yes.
That you have to be, because I didn't believe. There came then a time when I used to get so many offers from other universities, which didn't interest me. And all my friends were saying, well, go to the chairman and tell you have that offer, so you'll get promotion and anything. And they said, but I don't want it. Because why should I go and say there I have that I know that I won't accept it? Mm-hmm. So I've never did it. I think it all went naturally.
Well, that's interesting because, of course, now this is expected that professors are always on the market, chronically on the market, just to get some compensation.
Well,
that is
yes,
equal
but that
to
is
other
what
schools.
I consider so wrong because when I got all these offers, then also my friends were saying, well, go and show those offers because you'll get a salary increase.
Yes.
And I said, I don't sell myself. Like when I had, I think once or twice, an offer of almost twice the salary. Because they needed a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wrote back to those people, I don't sell myself. I mean, money isn't everything in life.
Well, I'm afraid the university has changed since your days. Let's put it that way. But anyways, I assume not everyone was like that in your.
Well, no, but of course, I did myself some harm. I could have had a much better salary.
You
I was
have,
always way down from the men, my salary. Way down.
Well, that, I mean, and that really didn't affect your sense of fairness or justice in terms of the status of women, or you really were more
Well, I was more interested in research.
I see.
And I couldn't get bothered with economic questions. That, unfortunately, all my life, money was never the first thing for me.
Well, and it sounds as if you had a calling and you saw your work in a way
was more important.
As the important thing.
Yeah.
And some of these other things were not of sufficient.
Exactly. Exactly. Because we have a very good library here.
Yes.
You know, not every university does have that. Okay. Those smaller colleges write to offer you the good salary and everything, and you go there, and what do you do if there is not a good library?
Yes.
No. And I didn't know what quality of students I would find, whereas we really had good students.
Mm-hmm. And there was a broad excellence in the humanities.
Well,
exactly.
I mean, you had interchange so much.
Yes.
And that's so important. I always advise students to take at least one course in a different department.
Yes. And you had people like Stanley Payne and history and George and, you know.
Well, the French department was good. The Italian department used to have very interesting people.
Mm-hmm.
So?
German.
But German we had a little less probably because I think the German literature has influenced less the Spanish writers.
Okay.
So
I can imagine, yes. Okay. So you're in Madison now. You are developing your career. So I think we have covered your first years.
Mm-hmm.
And when you first arrived, where was the department located?
In Bascom.
Oh, it was in Bascom Hall.
Mm.
Okay.
It was nice.
It was nice. You preferred it there to...
It was not as comfortable. There was not that much space, but it had tradition.
Yes, and you were, in a sense, in a space where you had to engage with your colleagues.
Exactly.
And in a more traditional setting.
Yes.
And... you then in 19, I think it was 1968 that Van Hise opened?
Probably.
Mm-hmm. And then you ended up in this kind of...
Which I didn't like at
all. ...situation where there were these boxy little offices along a very narrow... Well,
so inhuman.
Yes, and so lacking in collegiality, yes, the spaces.
Exactly.
Because everyone could kind of just emerge or hide as they saw fit. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that did change the feeling of the department,
I don't think it affected it much. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
Okay. All right, so, let's talk then about your, courses that you taught in those years. Were you teaching language courses, literature courses?
Language I taught when it was absolutely unavoidable.
Okay.
But I preferred literature courses. Okay.
So you taught Spanish poetry?
Yes.
Literature?
Novel, or general culture. But pure language, yes, I had. I think we all always had to teach at least one language course.
Okay, this was kind of required.
Yes, and I think that is just because I mean, you couldn't say you can enjoy your literature courses and you will just slave for the language. Yeah.
Well, there's always that tension, of course, in the departments, and often it's turning out that the beginning courses are taught, of course, by TAs.
Yes, yes. Well, that was mostly because we was having so many students.
Yes.
You have to do it with... And I think for the TA, for the graduate students, it's a very good experience.
Indeed, yeah.
Very good experience.
It's very good for them. So, did you enjoy teaching? Did you have a real passion for it? It did it depend on the class, the students?
No, passion, I would not call it. But I enjoyed teaching because I wanted to make what I taught accessible to students who probably might not come across it otherwise. Mm-hmm. And, we had rather big classes. There were always one or two students who made it worthwhile. Definitely.
So it really, is always the case.
Mm-hmm.
There are really excellent students.
Yes, absolutely.
Enriching to
work
with.
Yes, because, I mean, you learn from the students. Yes.
And yes, indeed. It's, always the case at a big public university, which has many, many functions, that you will get, some excellent students, and then you'll get the middle group, and then you'll get the ones that are really struggling.
Mm-hmm.
It seems always to be. And that is a way that one learns to teach. And,
exactly.
Yes. Exactly. Okay. Okay. Well, then let's talk a bit before we get into the Institute and some of the great scholars you worked with. Let's talk a bit about your scholarship. You started out working on Spanish poetry, and it looks like this is a subject that you engaged with throughout your career.
Absolutely. That is definitely my main interest. But you know what happens when you teach, you cannot teach only poetry because there are always fewer students for poetry than for anything else. So when you teach other courses, you suddenly get interested in certain aspects and then you want to also investigate that more and then you eventually write about it.
Okay. So that's the process that you...
That's in my case.
Okay.
Because you cannot talk about a literature if you just separate one section.
And this attention to poetry, this love of poetry, really was stimulated in 1953, and it's something that you've really maintained your whole life.
Oh yeah, I still am more interested in poetry, and luckily in Spain still are wonderful poets.
Well, it sounds like, well, it looks as if you wrote both cultural criticism and also anthologies of specific poets in, and then books on style in poetry.
And in novel too.
In the novel, yeah, okay. And
no, but the book that most people quote when they meet me is a book which I did because I wanted to please that one professor who inspired me, Blekwa. He said, you cannot go just always on contemporary poetry and do something that's easy. Make an edition of a great classic. Okay. And that is my Góngora edition. And that is what people know me. For what the people know me in Spain.
Okay. You were the first one to compile.
Complete.
Yes.
I mean, it's a big edition. And I mean, I did what my professor said, which not many people do. I went to every library in which there was a manuscript.
In Spain.
Spain, in Portugal, in Italy, in Germany. It took quite a bit. But it's necessary if you want to see how in those days the text can change from one transcription to another transcription, because after all, 17th century. So it took some time.
So this was a critical edition. You did annotations, you did introductions.
Yes, establishing the real text and then so. Oh, and in this context, I can tell you my only experience negative for being a woman. One manuscript is at one monastery in Spain. They did not let me in to consult it because I was a woman.
How did you end up getting access to it?
I didn't send a man. That one I didn't see.
Isn't that a shame? Well, tell me a bit about the mechanics of doing research in those years, because it would have been, you know, now, of course, with technology, it's different.
Oh, totally different. But I believe in the old method. You went, you did not go through any electronic devices. You went to the place. You looked at the original text. You felt the pages. I mean, it's something totally different. You live with that book.
With the object. And very absorbed much. More than just
exactly.
something that's
exactly, because also I discovered, you know, in the 17th, 18th century, how these manuscripts were being copied. Sometimes they in one manuscript, for instance, big manuscript, all my poet was there, and then I go a few pages later, cooking recipes. interesting.
Yeah. To see that.
I think it only allows you to see fully the culture of the time when you touch them. That was a very tedious job. It was long and not easy, but I'm very grateful for the professor who suggested to me to do it. And actually, it was he, and then there was another scholar of the Golden Age, Rodriguez Monino. So when I told him somehow that I could either ask somebody else to look just at a few poems and so on, he said, no, you go and look. You must see the whole volume. So I traveled across Spain quite a bit.
Did you get research funds for that?
No, I had that only,
later. So this was pretty much
financed. No, for Gogumra I had the funds.
Oh,
but
you did.
I mean, yeah. It was very limited. So to make all these trips was not easy.
Mm, I can imagine. Mm-hmm. In those years in mm-hmm. particular, in mm-hmm. out-of-the-way places.
Exactly. But it was absolutely necessary.
Well, it just experiencing where these manuscripts ended up, the whole atmosphere of the library or wherever where they were.
Very much.
Were,
and you know, the accessibility or any, like in one library in Spain, that professor of mine also gave me the advice. He said, and you know, from time to time, take a package of cigarettes to the man who looks for it.
Yes, that's
it was good advice.
Indeed.
It was good advice.
Yeah, you have to make friends with those people. Mm-hmm. So what attracted you to Gongora? Was it...
that was Blackwell's suggestion.
Oh, okay. It was just his suggestion.
Yeah, that was his suggestion because he had just finished the monumental edition of Quevedo, more or less of the same period. Okay. And he said, and Gongora is still waiting.
I see. So he was... He, as your mentor,
yes,
pointed
yes.
you in the right
he
direction.
He pointed me in the right That's direction great. And even gave me a few references in the National Library in mm-hmm. Madrid. He told me, oh, there are some, at least some pages, so just insist and look.
Yes.
And I found everything.
We're resuming the interview with Professor Beritica Plascaite, sorry for the pronunciation, after a short break. Beirute, we were discussing your book on Gongora and the impact that it had in Spain and on your career. I notice, now that I have the book, that it was published by the Hispanic Seminary of Medieval Studies, which I gather was affiliated with the Department of Spanish at the University of Wisconsin.
Yes, and really I had forgotten already about it. I don't even remember exactly when I prepared that edition, but I had no contract with anybody or anything. I was just interested in doing it, and I did it. And so then I came back from Spain, and it was there. But that... I think a year, maybe later or so, that I went to the Institute and we were talking about, you know, the works and
you
so on.
You went to the Institute, meaning
as,
that you
already
were
appointed,
as a
life member.
And that is the Institute for Research in the Humanities.
In the Humanities. And then the director, Bob Kingdon, when I mentioned my research at Gongora and said, and he said, well, and where it's being published, and I said, well, he said, well, but you do have the medieval Spanish publishing. Well, why don't you do it there? And I don't remember now whether he talked to them or whether I talked to them. Mm-hmm. And they said yes.
So essentially the Spanish department in those years had this publishing arm.
Yes.
That published this major book of yours.
Yeah,
that's
but
really
they were not interested without Kingdon.
Kingdon was the key.
Bob Kingdon talked to them, and he said, well, this is something that's important.
Bob Kingdon was, of course, the professor
The director of the Institute at that time.
History and then director of the Institute for Research in the Humanities.
No, it's to Bob 70s. That I really have to be grateful for it.
That's wonderful.
And they did a beautiful job.
They
it's
did.
Huge, it's a beautiful
huge
edition.
Amount of work. Yes, it is. And you worked with copy editors. They provided you with support, or was it pretty much that you...
No, I had already everything.
I
gave them the materials, and I think then I just proofread.
Okay, so I see that this is a very complex...
Oh, it is. It was.
Publishing project,
yes.
And it was very well done.
Yes,
and this
yes.
is amazing that
I was
your department
lucky.
Had
I was
this,
lucky.
This ability to do that. I think this is probably the direction more departments should go in these days.
Probably.
But
because I think really it was money well spent.
Yes,
and it was sold out, And in Spain, people really got this material thanks to our department. Can you imagine?
That's amazing.
Yes.
Yes.
One of the most important poets in Spain of all ages, that it should be published in Madison.
Indeed. No? And then be now a classic.
Yes.
Spain still.
But then that was not that many years ago that they finally bought, I think, the rights and they, published exactly, facsimile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that brings up, let's talk a little bit more about your scholarly work before we transition into your association with the Institute for Research in the Humanities. So you moved then into writing after this very well received, book, critical edition of the poetry of Góngora.
Mm-hmm.
You moved into the poetry of Jorge Guillén, and I see that was published in Mexico, and I assume circulated in the Spanish-speaking world. I mean,
I had even forgotten that.
Yeah, and so then there's another book that you edited on Guillén.
Oh yes, the different articles of many important scholars.
Yes. Okay. And then another book on Góngora. Now you publish. It looks like this is a.
You probably have a list of some articles that have been included in books.
I see. Okay.
But which I did not edit.
Okay. All right. So this is a book. Sida Bernucas. Ir as.
Oh, that is a translation of another Spanish poet.
Okay.
Great
into
poet
Lithuanian.
Into Lithuanian. Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. I see. And that was published in Madison.
Yes, because I used in Madison during quite a number of years when I made connection with our publishing things.
Yes.
I always prepared a little booklet as a Christmas greeting for my friends.
I see.
And I paid for it.
Okay, all right. So then you started working on women in Spanish literature, mm-hmm. and in particular women poets. It looks like the first book was The Unsatisfied Women, Adultery,
oh, yes.
And the novel, a realistic novel, published in Barcelona. So, tell me why you started working on women's literature. I don't know if you would call it that, or women in literature, and then specific women writers. What was the impetus, and what do you think this contributed?
Well, the reason was that at that point nobody wrote anything about women,
In Spanish,
and yeah, they were taught much less, and there mm-hmm. were some good writers.
Mm-hmm. And you had identified some of these
yes.
writers?
No, the mm-hmm. people knew the writers, but they simply shoved them aside, dismissed. Yes.
Fascinating.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Oh, okay. There was a long time that in Spain, the woman just was not worth anything.
And this is not that long ago. We're talking the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know,
30 yes.
years
yes.
ago. That is
yes.
not that long ago. And so you met this scholarly need, but mm-hmm. also it was, of course, an interest of yours.
Absolutely, because, I mean, the quality of the writing, why should be it left aside while people wrote and spoke and published about men who were inferior
huh.
to them.
Okay.
So, I mean, you have to show people that there are also, there have been women in Spain who have been writing and who have been doing good writing.
So this resonated with your approach on these matters also,
yes,
that
yes.
you felt very much that it was,
yes.
you know, that's the way to approach yes. these things, to be better, to be, you know, to recognize.
Well, because actually, even when I started teaching or anything, in order to be treated as equal, you have to be better.
Yes.
Otherwise, they weren't interested.
You were easily dismissed mm-hmm. if you were mm-hmm. average.
Mm-hmm.
And God help you if you were below average.
Exactly.
You were really in trouble.
Exactly.
Unlike many men, you know.
Exactly.
You could be fine being below average. So it looks like you wrote both critical commentary
yes.
and literature, mm-hmm. but also on specific women writers. And in terms of your critical writing, were there any themes or discoveries that you made, or was it more that you were a pioneer?
No, I wouldn't call myself a pioneer, but I was reading, you know, and when you read and realize that it's a very good piece of literature and
yes.
nobody speaks about it, you want to bring it to the attention.
Okay. No one had really mm-hmm. Written on this, and you felt that this
yes,
was...
Yes, that I should call attention
yeah.
and then let the reader decide.
Uh-huh. And begin the process of scholarly
yes.
investigation.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I see that you you translated a book of the poetry of Maria Victoria Atencia.
Oh, yes. She is, in my opinion, she still is the greatest poet in Spain.
Really? Male or female? She's the greatest poet?
Greatest female.
Okay.
Definitely.
And so your friendship with her, your work on her goes back many, many years.
Yes.
I see that this
yes.
is a translation into Lithuanian
poetry. Oh, yes.
Poetry.
That was another of my little Christmas books.
Ah. So essentially you started also then to work again in your native language, Lithuanian, mm-hmm. in these years. So did you write a critical edition of Atencia's work?
No. In Lithuania, you know, you had to be kind of only general introduction.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, if you would present a really scholarly piece on one unknown poet, nobody would read it. Nobody
mm-hmm.
would buy it. Nobody.
Okay.
Would.
But what about in Spanish? Did you write anything on her in Spanish?
Oh, I think I have written several.
Oh, you okay? I haven't seen.
Probably.
Okay, so what is it about her poetry that is so?
Well, that is it, because it is poetry. It's inspiring. It's not saying. It is making you realize many things that are not said.
Mm. Things that are in particular a women's voice, I mean.
No. It's just good poetry.
It's just good
poetry.
Okay.
Mm.
And there's no, you haven't really written any theoretical books or articles that
totally theory, no.
No theory. Okay.
No.
Are there theories that you ascribe to that you've used in your work? Any literary theories that have resonated more?
No, I would not say. I could not name that. I think that you have to have a very different approach in mm-hmm. order to come to the essence. Using just one method, I don't think you get very far.
So you have used what you felt worked.
Exactly.
As it was needed.
Exactly.
And you've, okay. Okay, so.
Because unfortunately, when women, maybe not today anymore, but before when I started, when they were writing about women's writing, it was always with a tendency to defend or to attack.
I see.
And I don't believe in that. I think when I write about a literary work, I want to speak about literature and not about politics.
Mm-hmm. And the people that you wrote about were people that you knew
that they
were of
were
excellent
great role. Authors.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Right. Not the message, but how they transmit the message.
This was really before the popularity of cultural studies and
mm-hmm.
identity
mm-hmm.
studies
mm-hmm.
and yeah, okay. All right. So, is there anything else that you want to say about your work on women in Spanish literature?
No, it's just
okay.
that it has been very interesting.
Okay.
And very satisfactory.
And did you, I know you wrote an excellent lecture on Renee Long, whose work annotated in at the library.
At the library. That was for me very interesting. She did, she was a pioneer.
Mm-hmm.
Because she really wanted to show what a woman is capable of doing. And very well grounded. I mean, there were not empty affirmations. You could always believe what she said because she gave proof.
We should mention Renee Long was a scholar of French literature who taught at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and her archive is at the Department of Special Collections at UW-Madison.
I think she really did very important work.
Yes. And was not recognized really for it, partially, I would say, because of some of her own characteristics.
Exactly.
Also because of, anyways.
But there are, in those archives, there are letters of her students, really full of admiration and
indeed.
Acknowledging how she opened their eyes and everything.
Yeah.
No, I think she did very important work.
Do you know why she never got a position at UW? I know she always wanted one
at
UW-Madison.
I don't know,
okay.
really. You know, that was in the days when she started. It was still rather closed for women.
Okay.
And as you said also, she was not a very easy person.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That, I only saw her once, I think, but from her correspondence and all the papers, I have the impression that she was not easy to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A kind of vindictive.
Ah, yes. Yeah. And, we won't talk anymore about her. But,
no.
Okay, so you moved a bit into translations of Spanish poetry, Spanish literature into Lithuanian.
Mm.
And did you also translate Lithuanian poetry or literature into Spanish or English?
I think one or two poems maybe into Spanish. English is not my language.
Okay. No. So you mostly have written in Spanish in your work.
Mm.
Feel very comfortable in that language, in writing and explicating. Do you dream in Spanish? Is Spanish your...
Oh, I dream in different languages.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you know many languages. How many would you say?
Well, I don't know how many and you know to what extent, but I mean I feel very comfortable in Spanish, French, German, Italian to a certain point.
English. And Lithuanian.
Yeah, and then others, you know, less like Portuguese. I have even lectured, I think, in Portuguese, but that's already not one of my fluent languages.
What about Polish and Russian?
No, those I can read.
You can read.
I can read. Strenuously, but I can read. Mm-hmm. Okay. No, I read. I mean, every year I read Tolstoy's War and Peace in the original. That's my favorite book of all the books.
Really?
That's true.
Okay, well, we haven't gone into
You asked me for publications, so I have here all the publications,
yes.
And even short articles, you know, and then longer essays in other books, but I gave it to you.
Well, we will... is there anything else you want to say about your scholarly work now? We can revisit this if we decide to later.
I don't think so.
But suffice to say, this was you felt was your main contribution, and this was your great passion. And
my passion. Yes, definitely.
Yes, writing.
I don't know how much of a contribution, but I mean, I just wanted to do it.
Okay. Well, let's talk then about your affiliation with the Institute for Research in Humanities at UW-Madison and what this has meant to you in your career. So in year were you appointed?
I think you must have it in my CV.
Okay. I think it was 1973, but...
Probably.
Yeah, okay. So it was in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And, well, describe the milieu, the people that were there, the director.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Were there visiting scholars?
Were always. I mean, the Institute was really heaven. I think it has changed quite a bit. But there were always visiting scholars from different countries on different subjects. The beauty there is also that you are not just closed in literature, that you have history, that, you know, it just branches out much more. So that it always gives you ideas. And the beauty of it was, I don't think it is anymore, the luncheon, because there are always many people from outside of Madison. So they all come, each has his office, and all have lunch.
Together.
And is where you get the tremendous amount of ideas from very different approaches, from very different fields, and not presenting, simply talking. That was the beauty. Mm-hmm. I think today it's not quite the same anymore. But that cannot be. And the beauty, of course, is also that there have always been people not only from universities in the States, but from other countries. So there is even more interchange because in every country, there are different directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you recall some of the visiting scholars that made a major impression on you and your work, or some of your colleagues at the Institute and staff members, others that may have been memorable to you and influenced your life and work?
Well, influenced my life is probably saying too much, but there have been, in the field of Spanish, from England, several wonderful scholars. really enriching. And you see, the beauty is that it should not be only interesting to me, mm-hmm. but they, when they talked about their work, they made it interesting for other members of the Institute who were not at all in literature. That is the great gift.
Do you recall some names?
Yes. There was Edward Wilson from England, Roy Jones from England. They were just great.
I see.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. And who on the faculty was there as permanent members in those years?
Know,
there was Bob Kingdon.
Bob Kingdon was there because he was also director for quite a while.
Yes,
you know.
Right, for many
but
years.
I think Cronin is really to be given great credit. He knew how to choose. I think he also paid attention to see that many fields would be represented, you know, not just, let's say, English or just that or that, no.
Yeah.
So that the interchange was just wonderful.
And David Cronin was the Dean of Letters and Science and oversaw the Institute and also was...
He was director.
He was the director also. Okay. Because the first director was Marshall Claggett.
Yes, whom I didn't reach. No.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, but I would say, since we're speaking about the Institute, that the soul of the Institute and the success of the Institute and the beauty of the Institute was Loretta Freidling.
Really? Well, that's
the
great.
Executive Secretary.
Yeah.
I mean, totally dedicated to it, making everybody comfortable and happy. She had to take care of finding lodgings for the foreign visitors, taking care of if anything happened, problems. Loretta is unique, absolutely unique.
And she made everyone feel that they were her primary focus of attention.
She inspired confidence. People mm-hmm. knew that if any problem arises, she will be able to solve it.
She is a solver.
And not imposing herself, never talking about herself. She was just in the background, but she was managing.
And she created the sense of community.
Oh, very much.
Is that what you're saying?
Very much. Checked that everybody is comfortable, that for the people from outside, that they are lodged all right. She looked for the lodgings. I have not met such an efficient person in my life as she.
And so dedicated.
Totally. Totally.
So she recently retired, I think, at the age of 82 from that position, having worked since mm-hmm. the beginning of
yeah,
the
Yeah, but
Institute.
She could have still remained.
Mm-hmm. So there was Bob Kingdon and David Cronin.
Yes.
Was Alain Marx involved?
Yes,
Germaine,
I would say.
Madeleine.
You see, Germaine Brebe was already gone when I joined the Institute. Madeleine Doran, I think, was also... It was important that there were women, you know, from the very beginning.
Yes.
Yeah.
From the beginning. Yes.
From the very beginning.
And Madeleine Doran, of course, was from the English department.
Yes.
Hélène Marx,
yeah, she was very, very inspiring also.
Okay.
Maybe strong in some of her opinions, but quite an addition, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And generally fair and even-handed.
Yes, and...
Okay. Anything else you want to, anyone else you remember from those years?
Particularly from those years? You know, my memory is failing, as I told you. Right now I cannot think of anybody else.
Okay, we can revisit this.
But it was really just a happy community, and the beauty of it was that there were so many fields represented.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
it was, it never tended to just be concentrating on one thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was always an addition.
Or one approach, or one...
Yes, no, no, everybody, yes. Mm-hmm. Because everybody really was... people who were brought to the Institute were outstanding people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Outstanding.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, I think let's...